Brotherly Lovelessness, the second talk on the life of Joseph, Jacob's son, in a series entitled Our Times Are in His Hands, was presented by Dave Smith on July 10, 2011, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Once upon a time, there was a guy named George, let's say. Not his real name, George. He's a normal guy until one day George noticed that somebody else he knew, we'll call him Mike, had something that George didn't have, but George really wanted. Could have been most anything. Could have been a wonderful wife. Could have been an outgoing personality. Maybe Mike had a job with a pension to look forward to. Maybe a certain position in their church. Maybe Mike was a business owner and had conscientious, hardworking, honest employees, maybe a reasonable boss, perhaps it's season tickets to the Bach Festival, or maybe tickets to the Women's World Cup in Germany. It could have been, you know, pretty much anything. And then it happened. Something very odd happened. George's coloring began to change from flesh tones with a little bit of tan, because he was out in the sun some, his face, his arm, you know, a little farmer's tan. But his coloring began to change from his normal flesh tones and tan into a shade of green, though not because he was a big Duck fan, although undoubtedly he was. He got greener and greener and greener, until one day it was really pretty much no longer George at all. He had been transformed into something else. The green had eaten him alive, swallowed him up, completely consuming him. George suffered along the way and then was transformed, and it wasn't pretty. Ironically, Mike was pretty much unaffected by all the impact on George. And George, sadly, did not live happily ever after. The end. If you have your Bibles, I'd invite you to open up to the very first book of the Bible, first book of the Old Testament, the book of Genesis. We're going to be in chapter 37 this afternoon. We are in the second week of 5 weeks looking at some studies in the life of an Old Testament character by the name of Joseph. This is a narrative section, quite different from a reasoned argument passage in Scripture as we've been looking at lately. This is more of a narrative section. We're going to take a look at a few episodes in Joseph's life and seek to draw some, first understand it, and then seek to draw some takeaways for us today, some life lessons, you might say, just some observations based on the story there in Joseph's life. As I mentioned last week, Joseph's life is basically a textbook example of a foundational and incredibly encouraging verse in chapter 28 of the book of Romans, which says, for we know that God causes all things, not some, I added that, all things, to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. Kay, my wife, pointed out last week during the discussion time that the purpose, the good that Paul has in mind there is spelled out in the following couple of verses, where essentially it talks about how people who are believers will end up with a great destiny, that God will stay at work in them and bring them to completeness in Christ in the life to come. So all things in this life work together for good toward that end. In Joseph's case, he had a really up and down life in everyday life and in his life in this realm. And a lot of people have talked about how there are a number of bad episodes in Joseph's life that ultimately led to good consequences even in this life. And Joseph himself talked about that late in his life, as some of you may be aware. So looking at Joseph's life, that's easy for me to say, looking at his life can be an encouragement, I think, as we see God at work. Last week, old Joseph paid us a visit here today. He was busy today, so he didn't come. Somebody asked me today if I was going to bring the J, and I didn't. But so Joseph isn't here. Today, we will pick up his story in chapter 37 of Genesis when he is 17 years old. Just by way of reminder and review, he was the firstborn of Rachel, who was his father's favorite wife of the four he bore children by. He was the firstborn of Rachel, but he was just the 11th of 13 children that his father Jacob had. And Joseph, as we'll see in this section, was not a big hit with his 10 older brothers, as we launch into the narrative of the story today. We'll look at the account in verses 1 through 11. I've called it Family Feud. It'll continue on into our section next week as well. We'll look at it, and along the way, I will highlight three takeaways for our consideration today. It is about 3,500 years later now than when this historical account occurred, but as we'll see, people are people, and hopefully there'll be some things we can benefit from as we look at this today. So, Family Feud, chapter 37 of Genesis, the first couple of verses, a family with wealth. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Those are two of them. And he brought their father a bad report about them. So we see here Jacob, and as you recall, Jacob is in the line of the patriarchs. It began with Abraham. God came and made some fantastic promises to him about the future of Abraham's family, future of his seed, and then later on we learn his seed in the faith as well, his spiritual seed. So there's Abraham, and then next in the line God chose was Isaac, one of Abraham's sons, and now this is Jacob, and then Jacob has a whole slew of sons, most of whom later became the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's a little bit of context. And what we see in verse 2 here is that Joseph was tending the flocks with his brothers. It doesn't really say it here, but by doing some research and also kind of looking at the story as a whole, it's evident that it wasn't just a few sheep, that it was a lot, that they were a family of means. They were a wealthy family. A well-to-do family, not a poor family. And that leads to the first sort of obvious, I think, takeaway that I wanted to highlight for today, and that's this. Family wealth does not guarantee family harmony. Now, this is pretty obvious, isn't it, to all of us if we stop and think about that for a moment or two. You're sensible people. If you sat and thought about it, you'd realize that family wealth doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in the family is going to get along. But if we don't stop and think about it, I think it's possible that we could be lured into What I think may be a fairly popular view in our culture, at least it seems to me that I've heard it in our culture and perhaps in our churches, and the view would say something like this. Someone would say, well, all of our problems would pretty much go away if we just were not always fraught with worry about how we're going to pay the rent or the phone bill. You know, if we just had enough money, we wouldn't have all this stress and this pressure. There's lots of strife here, but it's born of this underlying tension about money. Have you heard anything like that? Maybe you've thought something like that as well. Well, as we look at the Bible, it's evident that having adequate money is not going to solve all of life's problems or all of life's disputes. Certainly, there's nothing wrong with having money, and it's always nice to be able to pay one's bills, and certainly it can relieve the pressure of paying the bills. But just because we have enough money to pay the bills, that does not eliminate the possibility of disharmony within a family, because every family is filled with sinners, as we all are, and having plenty of money is not going to solve our sin problem. On the other side of that, not having enough money is not automatically more spiritual. In other words, people are not more valiant or more noble if they choose to live in poverty. Some Christians teach that, and I think that's foreign to the Bible as well. So that's kind of on the other side. Sin, as well as God's redeemed people, live in all kinds of neighborhoods. Lives in wealthy neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods, and poor neighborhoods. Mr. Trouble, in the form of human conflict, visits every neighborhood, every home. And that's just an indication of another indication to all of us why we need the grace of God through Christ, and why we need his work in our lives, for those of us who are rich and those of us who are not so rich, for those of us who are adults, for those of us who are kids, for men and for women. It's for all of us. Okay, so this is a family with wealth. We advance now and look at the next couple of verses where it talks about a family with favoritism. Verse 3 of chapter 37. Now Israel, another name for Jacob, not a country Israel, but Jacob, the person. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him, Joseph had been born to Jacob, in his old age. So we see here that Jacob was playing favorites. And in a way, you can imagine why that would be. Jacob's other sons were older. They're growing up. All of us who are parents who have kids, we know that they do grow up and they move on, much to our chagrin generally, and we think how rude of them to actually grow up and leave. And Jacob undoubtedly was delighted to have another son, and in particular from a son who was born from his favorite wife, the wife he worked for 14 years in essentially as an indentured servant in order to gain consent to marry her. And so finally they have a son together. So it's understandable that Jacob would find it tempting to favor Joseph. So it's not surprising that he would attach himself to Joseph. It's not wise, of course, to pick a favorite child. We all know that. But Jacob here with a treasure in his old age, the son of his lifelong, or not lifelong, but his, well, for the rest of his life, love, Rachel. So we can envision likely that Joseph and Jacob enjoyed one another, and perhaps they were buddies, perhaps they were constant companions, an elderly father and a tender-hearted young son. That leads to the second obvious, I think, observation coming out of this passage, a second takeaway, not real new or complicated, but I thought I'd highlight it briefly. Family favoritism is a foolishness that can lead to fury. It can cause problems, and we're going to see later today and especially next week the kind of fury that it causes. So obviously, parents, we don't probably need this reminder, but by the grace of God, we really ought to avoid favoritism within our families. It's a bad idea. It certainly doesn't help the non-favorites particularly, and it doesn't do the favorites any favors either, really. Joseph, having been favored, didn't really find that his life was a bowl of cherries. In fact, pardon the pun, it was a bit more like cherry pits and other kind of pits that we're going to see Joseph being thrown into. Okay, so where does this favoritism that Jacob is expressing toward Joseph, where does it lead to? We're told the answer to that as we continue reading in verse 3. And Joseph made a richly ornamental robe, and Jacob made a richly ornamental robe for Joseph. This is the verse that leads to what is probably out there in the common culture, the main thing that people know about Joseph, right? This, the Andrew Lloyd Webber Broadway play. What'd they call it? I wrote it down. Joseph, the Technicolor, what is it? Sorry? And the Technicolor Dreamcoat. There you go. Came from this verse. As it turns out, however, it may not actually be a multicolored coat at all, as far as the translation is concerned. It might be that, but it also, as I understand it, might be just a description of a certain kind of coat. One translation calls it a full-length robe, where, unlike a typical garment of the day that would be sleeveless and that would not go, I don't know how far down, not go much past the knees, I think, but certainly not down to the ankles, this one went to the wrists on the arms and then all the way down to the ankles. So it was a special coat. Exactly in what way, maybe we're not sure exactly what it all looked like, but it was a special coat. And what did the loving brothers think of this gift from Jacob to Joseph? How did they feel about that? Well, we're told, verse 4, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. They hated him. We're going to see statements like this three different times just in these six verses. There was so much hatred, the text says, that they couldn't even utter a courteous word. You can use your imaginations and think about the Jacob family dinner table, huh? Everybody's sitting around, there is Joseph with this demonstration of the father's favoritism toward him, smack dab in the faces of the rest of the family. And how did the brothers react? Well, they couldn't even say, "Please pass the salt." How was your day, little brother? That kind of thing, I think we can conclude, was the kind of feel to what was going on, tension in the household because of the favoritism demonstrated by this coat. Well, why was the coat a problem, we might ask? Can't a parent have the freedom to give a gift to one child if the parent wants to do that? Apparently, the problem was the meaning in the coat, the significance of this coat, what it represented. One writer put it this way: it is the coat of one who is served, not of an ordinary worker. In other words, a coat that came down to the wrists and to the ankles would not be what a common laborer would wear, but someone sort of higher up on the totem pole. in the culture. And that was what the problem was, that Joseph, this young buck at the time, the youngest in the family, that he was, in a sense, promoted above the rest of them in his father's eyes. It was as if he had become the heir. It was as if he had taken on the privileges of the firstborn. So they hated him for this. Then as we continue, we hit the dream sequence of our story in verses 5 through 10. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose up and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" Remember, they're way older than he is. He's just 17-year-old. And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" Later on in the story of Joseph, we will see more of Joseph's experiences with dreams as an interpreter of other people's dreams. Actually, as Joseph himself points out, God is the interpreter. It isn't Joseph. It's God who's doing the interpreting. But we won't get to that in these 5 weeks. But if you were to read the story, you'd see that as well. That there are a lot of experiences that Joseph has with dreams. In this particular dream sequence, what it did was it added more fuel to the raging hatred toward him from his brothers, like bone-dry trees and shrubs feeding a summer wildfire in eastern Oregon or something like that. They were seething at him. They hated him all the more, the text says. That was after the first dream, and then there was a second dream, and more unpleasantness for the sons of Jacob. At this point, a number of people, as they're reading this, would ask, well, was it wise for Joseph to tell his already hostile brothers what these dreams were? It looks like Joseph took the initiative. Hey, I had this dream. You want to hear about it, or I'm going to tell you about it. Was that wise? I don't know. Last week when Joseph was visiting and there was the J around my neck, he talked about how the text doesn't really record obvious glaring weaknesses and sin and mistakes and so forth in his life, which is quite a distinction between most other Old Testament characters. We're quite aware of the weaknesses and problems and issues that the patriarchs had and many others in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament, even though there's a whole lot said about Joseph, there's almost recording of his complaining at God for his various circumstances and so forth. And so, having said that, we also know that the Bible teaches that all human beings are flawed. So Joseph certainly was born into sin just like the rest of us. He was a flawed individual, even if not a lot of it shows. This episode, however, might be one of those places. Commentators looking at this, some would say, well, he's just a kid. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's not nothing to get all excited about, no big deal. Other commentators point out that this really was inappropriate. This was wrong of Joseph to do. We have a student Bible around our house, a student study Bible, you know, that has side notes and extra columns and so forth. This particular one The side notes are written by Philip Yancey and our old college friend Tim Stafford. They wrote the notes for this particular Bible. And in this verse, they're quite critical of Joseph. So they would say this is an example of Joseph's mortality, his being a real person who struggles with sin like the rest of us coming through. But either way, he made the choice to tell his brothers about these dreams, and it continued and fueled additional aspects of the raging inferno of the brotherly lovelessness toward their 17-year-old brother. Before I move on, I wanted to say just a word or two about dreams and God. We won't be getting to the later sections where Joseph is interpreting other people's dreams, but most of you are probably somewhat familiar with some of that. So I just wanted to make a couple comments about dreams. This section is the first of several places in Joseph's life where experiences with dreams are highlighted. In the later ones, as I said, he interprets other people's dreams, which end up foretelling future events. In these dreams that we see in chapter 37, Joseph tells his family the dreams, and then they interpret them, and he doesn't correct them. And in fact, later on in the story, we see that what the brothers thought might happen, bowing down to him, did in fact happen. So in a sense, these were predictive dreams of what would happen in the future. And it led to the brothers being even more upset. And a question may pop into our heads at this point. And the question would go something like this. Are dreams that we have a normal or typical vehicle that God uses to communicate with his people? Is Joseph's experience here and later on in his life a pattern? Now, there would be some Christians who I think would say yes, that when you have a particular dream, that you should seek to interpret it because it may well be a message from God, that Joseph's dreamy episodes are examples that God intends for us to follow in the sense of paying attention to them and seeing whether it may be individual personal guidance or some anticipation of a future event or something like that. So the idea is we should look into these dreams and figure out if there's some significance beyond just what we might normally expect, which is that our escargot chocolate pizza that we had right before dinner or right before bed had some impact on our dreams. That might be what I would conclude, but maybe there's something more to that. Well, my response to that, certainly God can do whatever he wants to do, but does it appear as though, from a biblical standpoint, this is a norm? And I would say, no, I don't think so. A writer I appreciate a lot, the late Dr. James Montgomery Boyce, who was longtime pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. I've always wondered what the other nine were like, but he was the longtime pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church, a church which, in fact, our own David Crabtree, when he was in college, where are you, David? You attended there, right, for like a year or something like that, when you were at Penn, right? Did you start your freshman year was at Penn, and you came back to the Northwest? So David is David sat in the pews listening to Dr. Boyce, I guess, way back when. Anyway, Boyce says this about this section. He says, quote, "This does not mean that God always speaks in dreams or even that he does so at all in our day." He goes on to talk about how it's important to note, for example, how little significance dreams do have in the Bible, which is our inerrant authority of the mind of God. Really, there are only three places in the whole Bible, and it's a book big book covering thousands of years. There's only three places where dreams figure prominently at all. In this book, the book of Genesis, the book of Daniel, and the book of Matthew. And when God did make a big deal about dreams, it was very, very obvious to the people involved. Wow, this really is God. God took the initiative. Of course, dreams have to come from someplace, and God can do whatever he chooses. But if I were you, if you're wondering about this, I'd be cautious. I wouldn't lose any sleep, so to speak, over trying to decipher if there is some direction that God is intending through a dream that we might have or some message there. Like, ooh, that's an odd dream. Maybe God is telling me something. Yeah. Probably not, would be my input. I did have a dream, though. We're going to have enough time for me to say this. A couple nights ago, that maybe you could help me with a little interpretation. I was in a baseball game, and it wasn't when I was in high school, which was the last time I played baseball. It was when I'm my current ripe old age of 61. I was in a baseball game, and I was up at bat, and the first pitch came in, and I thought it was inside. The umpire disagreed and called it a strike. My daughter said, well, why didn't you, you know, yell at him or get in a fight with him? And that's not a good idea. So I just waited for the next pitch, was a ball. The next pitch, I'm quite sure, was low and outside. I know that it was out of the strike zone, but the umpire disagreed. And so now I'm in a bind, and I'm sweating in my sleep because, you know, I don't like to have two strikes on me because there's no room for error there, you know, and I hate to strike out. So the next pitch came, and I ripped it down the third baseline. So happy, and I headed off to first base, foul ball. So I had to come back, and it turns out when I was running down to first, somehow I had run right out of my shoes. My baseball cleats were sitting there on the ground. So they had to stop the game, and I put on my shoes and got back up to bat. And then you know what happened? I have no idea. I woke up. So I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm going to strike out or hit the ball or what I'm going to do. So that was my dream. As I say, probably nothing from God. Now, one last question, then I'll move on. Why is it that we don't really need dreams to hear from God the way Joseph heard from God through dreams? Well, my response to that would be this. God has already spoken authoritatively, without error, through Scripture. We are privileged to have his written word. We already have all the revelation that we need in order to pursue faith and godliness in this life. God has spoken. Joseph, on the other hand, had nothing written down for him, and we do. So in that sense, we are at an advantage over Joseph. Okay, enough about dreams. We finish up the narrative part of our story as we move on to verse 11. We've seen so far a family with wealth, a family with favoritism, and now we're going to see a family with jealousy. Verse 11, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Next time, next week, we'll see where this jealousy born of hatred ends up. We'll see that it ends up with murder in the heart and nearly murder in the flesh, physical, literal murder. For today, though, I want to stop and spend a few minutes talking about the topic of jealousy, the topic of envy, which is our third takeaway for today. Again, a simple observation, nothing complicated. Jealousy is terribly destructive. These brothers, as we'll see next week, were eaten alive by the monster of jealousy. Now, all of us, if we were to have a little test here, if we had a little true-false test this afternoon, all of us would score 100%. We'd get an A++ on the true-false test about jealousy. Is jealousy good, true or false? Now, we know that it isn't. We know that it's displeasing to God. But in addition, what we forget, I think, at times, is that not only is it inappropriate, but it also chews us up. It's harmful to us who are experiencing, perhaps nurturing, the envy or the jealousy. The book of Proverbs has a verse that says, "A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones." Jealousy or envy, I would define it as being when we are bothered at the good fortune of others. We don't like it that they got something that we really want. One writer says, "The happiness and success of others is a poison to the bloodstream of the jealous." Jealousy is a monster that will eat us alive and rob us of joy. So, as we think about our own life experience, what is it that we might envy? What is it that we might get jealous over? Well, you name it. It could be practically anything. For me, I am tempted to envy other people who are smarter than I am. I'm tempted to envy people who are wiser than I am. And those aren't the same thing, of course. There's being intelligent, and then there's being wise with your life. And I envy both. I am prone to envy people who are able to think quickly as they interact over a problem or interact in conversation. I am tempted to envy people who have solid, encouraging, supportive family relationships up and down the generations. I tend to envy people whose whose kids have Christian grandparents. Well, what might it be for you? I'm not going to ask you to say anything out loud, but what might that be? Maybe it's a marriage relationship. Maybe you're envious because other people seem to gain respect for who they are and what they think and how they live, and nobody seems to notice you. Maybe it's living in a certain part of town, or having a certain kind of house or property or apartment. Maybe you want to be friends with a certain person, and that person doesn't have time to be a friend to you, or would prefer to have other friends, and you're tempted to envy about that. Maybe you're envious of people who have the freedom and opportunity and means to take vacations to certain places you'd like to go, but you just can't, or maybe go on a vacation at all. Maybe someone else's friend is the one who got the good news from the doctor and who beat cancer and survived it, but your friend or loved one did not. There's all kinds of things that are prone to attack us and tempt us toward this self-destructive tendency that's very human, but still self-destructive. We humans can be very creative and resourceful about what we envy. We have a hard time sometimes with other people's successes and good fortune. A little way to determine that would be to maybe ask yourself, when you hear news of something good happening to another person, how is it that we respond? Is our first thought perhaps, gee, why didn't that happen to me? I wanted that. Why did they get that? It's a natural enough reaction, I think. But I think the key point is the next step. Then what did we do after we had that thought? Did we nurture that resentment and dwell on it and nourish it and kind of let it build within us to the point where we're thinking, yeah, I deserve what they got? Or do we recognize that it's the ugly monster of envy and seek by the grace of God to judge it, to condemn it, to reject it, to not succumb to it. In addition to its being kind of a natural question, a natural issue, yeah, I'd really, you know, I'm glad for them, but I'd really like to have had that too. The other important factor, I think, is this whole topic, it's also a trap for us. What I mean by that is this, it's fool's gold. We can't really win this game if we jump into this game. Why is that? Why can't we win? Because no matter what the circumstance is, there will always be someone else out there who has more or has better of what we want than we have. It's always going to be the case. So we can't win if we get on that treadmill. The wisest advice, it seems to me, is that by the grace of God, we just make the choice. I know it's not easy. I don't mean just as if it's easy, but we make the choice and seek the grace of God to not get in the game, to not get on that bus, because it has an insatiable appetite, to mix my metaphors. So why would we become jealous if we know that God opposes it and if we know it hurts us? Why does it get tempting? Well, as I thought about that, I thought of about three reasons why it can be a problem or a challenge for us. Undoubtedly, there are more, and maybe you don't like these three, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But three reasons that came to mind to me. One, with regards to envy, our culture encourages it. It's all around us. It's kind of fashionable. The advertising industry is designed to arouse envy. That's what they're trying to do. You won't be happy until you get such and such. Or you're not cool unless you have such and such. Could be a product, could be a service, you know, could be a certain toothpaste or certain clothes or maybe a trip to Tahoe or Winnemucca, wherever you want to go for your great vacations. So our advertising industry is designed to arouse envy. Also, I think certain politicians in our culture promote it. They want to make us envious. They want us to think it isn't fair that I don't have what that so-and-so has. And so these politicians promise to give us whatever it is that we think we're entitled to. Not only does our culture encourage it, but also our nature enjoys it. We are sinful creatures whose natural bent is the opposite of purity. We resist goodness and righteousness. And so we kind of enjoy a little dabbling in the ocean of envy from time to time. It feels kind of good. Now, in Christ, we are being saved from this tendency. As God is at work in us and as he opens our eyes to see the folly of it and the destructiveness of it, but it still is a battle for us. Not only does our culture encourage it and our nature enjoy it, but also our circumstances enable it. As I mentioned before, there will always be someone, something, somewhere coming to a neighborhood near you that has something that we'd like to have. Always. But as I've suggested, we can't win that game. It won't work. There will always be someone who has more or better. And in addition, if we do get what we really long for, an item in this world, it's not as great as we thought it was going to be, you know? Ultimately, we're not going to be satisfied in the depths of our being by anything in this life. The Bible, I think, is clear that we're not made to be fully satisfied by anything in this world. It's the life to come where that full and complete satisfaction is going to come. So we strive to get what we're anxious to get, and then it turns out not to be as great as we want it to be. This topic sometimes can show up in the leadership of Christian organizations as well. I was reading a book that Alistair Begg, who's a pastor outside Cleveland, Ohio, that some of us appreciate, he was talking in his work on Joseph, and he told a true story about a British pastor by the name of F.B. Meyer some time ago. And Meyer told this story about himself. And he talked about the time that another well-known pastor moved to the same town where Meyer was. This other guy's name was G. Campbell Morgan. And he came and kind of opened up shop where Meyer already was. And as sometimes happens, gradually people started drifting from Meyer's church over to Campbell Morgan's church. Meyer later wrote how envy and jealousy began to grip his soul about this, and how the only liberation he could find was to pray for the other guy, pray for Campbell Morgan, and to ask God to bless his ministry. Meyer prayed that God would bless Morgan's ministry so much that there would not be enough seats to hold all the people who wanted to hear the new guy, and so they'd have to go hear the old guy. That's what he prayed. So envy sometimes dresses up in all kinds of clothes. Well, a question might come up, is there hope for us? And absolutely there is hope. God is in control, and God is at work. God's at work in the lives of believers. Now, as we know, as any area of Christian growth, there is no pill we can take. There's no switch we can turn on that will bring about instant perfection or instant victory, people might say, when we're battling certain sins. But we can be sure that God, in his grace and mercy, is at work in all of his children, and that one day we will be freed from envy and jealousy. Maybe not in this life, but we will be one day freed from it. Are there things that can help us in the meantime? I think a couple things. One is, I think a start can be by recognizing envy for what it is and seeking to oppose it in ourselves instead of pretending that it isn't there or pretending that it isn't envy. It's a little unseemly, you know, no one wants to be envious and jealous and all that. So we kind of might not want to think of ourselves as capable of that. But I think a first step is to just recognize, well, that's what it is. And then, by God's grace, refuse to nurture it along, refuse to fan it into flames that could become a wildfire, which, even though it seems normal in our culture to do this, it's something that we are best off seeking to resist because it's actually self-destructive. And then a second thing that we can remember, I think, that can help us is this. Our wise and sovereign God is the one who's running the show. I've named this overall series, Our Times Are in His Hands, and they are. God is the one who engineers all of life's circumstances. He's developing the story of all of us, and he knows what he's doing. People who have good circumstances ought not to think that it's because they are so sharp or they're so talented or capable. It's because God made that choice. No reason for us to get fat-headed about that. And then people who have bad or hard or painful circumstances need not get discouraged because God knows what he's doing. God is at work and weaving together everyone's story the way he intends it to be woven. That raises one more thought, and then I'll wrap up. Think with me, if you will. If God is, in fact, providentially ruling his universe, if he is ruling and overruling in all circumstances, if he's sitting in the captain's chair of life's events, as I think the Bible teaches, then when we find ourselves becoming envious or jealous or bitter or angry at somebody else's better circumstances than ours, what is it that's actually happening underneath that? Do you see that? The resentment and envy toward others is essentially resentment against God. resistance to his plans in our life and the lives of other people. Joseph's brothers could have saved themselves a lot of trouble, a lot of problems, had they sought to pursue this course of action. If we find ourselves seething that someone else got the promotion at work or got the good news from the doctor or has a husband who actually cares, has a husband at all, has a wife who is interested in marital intimacy, whatever the issue is, if we're upset that someone else got that those things when we're hostile in our hearts toward them, really we're also opposing God and his intentions and plans in this world. Now, I'm not saying that to have a guilt trip at all. We all fail. We all struggle. But I just wanted to point out it's not a wise place to be. And resentment toward other people is deeper than that. If God is the one who's drawing on the canvas what life in this world is like. The good news is God is at work to bring redemption to us, and he'll bring us through it. And I think just thinking about these things can be part of how he's working. May we, by his mercy, may we permit in our spirits God to do what he intends to do in our lives and in the lives of other people for his glory and for our benefit. I'll wrap up with this little story and then we'll have some time for interaction. This is what I believe this is a true story from ancient Greek history. It seems that there was a statue erected in a prominent portion of a certain city, and this statue was to honor a famous athlete. Imagine that, honoring an athlete. Who would have thunk that? A rival athlete who was jealous of the success of his colleague decided that he would destroy the statue if he could. So one night, under the cloak of darkness, he moseyed over there with a hammer and a chisel and started chipping away at the foundation of the statue, hoping to weaken it and to bring it down. You know where this is going, don't you? You don't need to be clairvoyant to see this. Well, he finally weakened the statue enough that it fell, but it fell right on top of him, crushing him to death. His envy had led to circumstances that literally killed him. That's a vivid picture. By God's grace and mercy and strength, may we as his followers recognize the dangers and emptiness of envy before it destroys us. And may it free us from the jail of jealousy as we trust and know that God knows what he's doing, and that he will do what's best for us and for the lives of everyone around us. He's weaving a perfect garment. He's creating a perfect story. He gave his life for us, and he won't abandon us now or ever. Okie doke. I'm done. Questions, comments?
Thanks, Dave. Mm-hmm. So there's one little part at the beginning in the story you didn't talk about, and I was just going to throw it to you and see if you had any thoughts about it, because it's not explained exactly what's going on there. That's where Joseph's right at the beginning when he's out with his brothers. It's, if I'm remembering, we just closed it here, but I think it says something about he brought a bad report back to his father.
Yeah.
So you were raising the question about the text, what picture of Joseph is it painting? And so there is that question about recounting that dream, what does that say? Should he have done that or not? Do you have any thoughts on what that little piece is telling us? Is it saying something about Joseph, or is it just the circumstances? Or?
You're right, I didn't talk about that. I did read some other people's comments about that. As I recall, the consensus of the people I read, consensus doesn't mean it's true, of course, but consensus of the people I read seemed to indicate that they thought that Joseph was sent by his father Is that what it says there, or is that later? What I read talked about how Joseph, evidently Jacob wanted to know from Joseph something about what was going on with the brothers, and he reported something about them that wasn't untrue. It wasn't a bad report in the sense that he made something up, but it was a report of something that was unflattering to the brothers in some way, and so in that sense it was a bad report. Did you want to go somewhere with that?
No, I mean, you had raised the question with the next part about what are we thinking about Joseph, you know, as when he
right.
when he tells this story. So I was
so the question is, should Joseph not have done that kind of thing?
Well, I was just wondering, you know, yeah. is it trying to paint him as, you know, some kind of a tattletale or something? You know,
well,
he comes back and says, oh, you know, I was there, I saw them doing this stuff. Or is it saying something about the brothers? I mean, you know, is it that
right.
Joseph in his innocence is telling his dad that they are not conducting themselves the way they ought to?
It was
sure
the
myself.
Latter that, of the people I read. It was more the latter. It was Joseph was just responding to what his father was inquiring of him, in contrast to Joseph was kind of going out of his way to tattletale. But I don't know if the people I read know any more, really, other than what we have. I don't know. Has someone else studied this and thought about this question? So I don't know. Have you thought about it?
No, I wasn't. You could go both ways. I mean,
yeah.
if he's portrayed fairly positively throughout, you could see it as kind of distinguishing him from his brothers, that he had,
yes.
had more integrity than they did.
That's but the way people took it who I read. Okay. Somebody else?
Just taking off on Ron's point, most of us, when we were 17, or if we happen to remember a 17-year-old, not well known for their sensitivity. It's not our most sensitive time toward what other people are feeling and thinking. It just seems that what Ron brought up in that one line just fits the picture we're getting of the same guy who happily tells his brothers these dreams that any 12-year-old would figure out is going to make older brothers jealous.
And it did.
And it did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can picture that he might be the same guy who saw something going on, and even if Dad didn't ask, so how were the brothers behaving, may have just come home and reported to Dad, you know, these guys who you're the dad of, but remember, my mother's a different mother. They're misbehaving.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And
it
that
could
wouldn't
well be, John.
Wouldn't be too untypical of somebody that age with these older brothers.
Yep, certainly possible.
Especially since he undoubtedly knew they didn't like him a bunch.
Yeah, certainly possible. And then if that were the case, and if the brothers found out, I don't know if we're told, I can't remember, if we're told that they found out about this bad report he given, but that would obviously add even more hostility to the mix.
So how are verses 1 and 2 saying that they were a family with wealth?
Where I got that mostly was, well, it's not really obviously in here. It's in verse 2 where Joseph was tending the flocks with his brothers, and it doesn't say it was a lot of flocks, but from other stuff that I've read, and as we read the story more, it's evident that they have, that they're people of means, that they have wealth.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
It doesn't really explicitly say it here. It just mentions the flocks, and I moved on from there.
This is a little ways outside of what you're teaching on, but it seems like a lot of these problems perhaps could have been avoided if Jacob had decided only to marry one person. And so I'm wondering,
yeah.
Later on, God tells Solomon, I guess, not to multiply wives. Of course, he ignores that. But why do you suppose, given how many problems having multiple wives causes, God didn't make that pretty clear from the outset that I don't want you doing this. This is a bad idea.
So it's the question of polygamy in the Old Testament and not a lot of statements of condemnation about it, just kind of expressions that this is what happened and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of the question. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe somebody else knows better than I do about this. I from our vantage point, I think as we look at the opening chapters of Genesis, it's evident that God intended with regards to marriage for it to be one man and one woman for a lifetime. I think that, and then it's echoed in the New Testament as well. And I think you're exactly right that some of these problems that happened in the lives of these folks came at least partly because of the fact that there were multiple wives and all the other relationships and stuff. Stuff I've read about why God didn't make it more clear, why he didn't do something more, the only thing I've read about that is that it wasn't very satisfactory to me in terms of answering the question, but it was along the lines of God just decided to not make that an issue with them, a big issue, and go on from there. That's not very satisfying to me. Maybe other, have you read and thought about that?
Well, here's my thought. We're talking about this Bible as being instructional purposes to this, and many times they gave it, different people have married and they've had big problems
to find out that one woman is more than enough because the, all the kind of problems that comes out of having more than one wife and the kids not really being brothers and sisters.
Right.
And so if you look at it and if you think about it, there's a lot of examples why you shouldn't do that.
It's instructive to us, even though it was damaging to them maybe. So.
Oh, you mentioned that like it was the job of advertisers to, you know, make you envious of their products, and I was just, you know, so thankful that the government doesn't try to stoke envy between its citizens.
Yeah, I haven't ever noticed that myself. We can talk about that maybe on another occasion if you want.
I just had a comment about, you know, the wives.
Yeah.
And
thanks.
I could stand up for Jacob a little bit. He was tricked into marrying
yes,
the first wife. He
absolutely
really wanted to marry Rachel.
Right.
And so then he worked really hard, and then he got Rachel. And then the other two were the maids of,
right,
of those. And it was because they were jealous. They were trying to have kind of a race about how many kids they could have.
That's right. And it was the maids of the sisters who were his wives. It was Leah and Rachel's idea. It wasn't Jacob's idea,
yeah,
from what we can tell.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out, too, that the story doesn't start here. You know, and if you think about the history of Joseph's brothers and
right,
stepmothers and all of the jealousy and everything,
yeah,
that went on in his childhood and in all of these kids.
That's right.
All these boys, how they grew up and what they saw, it would seem just reasonable to continue that same,
yeah, that's a
hostility
good point, Judy,
and envy.
Right, yeah. The account of the family after Joseph was born, but before it focuses on Joseph, starting in chapter 30, yeah, that details some interesting goings-on. That's right.
I was just thinking about the wealth that Jacob had back in Genesis 32 and 33. As he's going to meet Esau, even it talks about him having 200 goats and 20 male, you know, all these different ones he sends out ahead. So even then, he had lots of herds. And about his dreams.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
you heard that right.
Genesis 32.
I should have mentioned that. That makes a better point than the way I said it. So thank you very much.
Anyway, about him telling about his dreams, you know, it probably wasn't a wise thing to do, but again, in God's sovereignty, the brothers then were able to look back when they did come to see him in Egypt and remember that God had planned this.
Yep.
And that he was in it. And so it helps us to see that, too, that he was in this all the time.
Absolutely.
Even if what he said himself wasn't wise, it was, turns out that we know about it then.
Yes, it's tremendously instructive and beneficial for us, that's for sure, you bet. And everybody else who, over the centuries, has read this story. Anything else? We're out a little early. Thank you very much. Have a great week.